Welcome to another episode of 30 Minutes in that New Testament. I'm Daniel Emery Price, joined by Eric Sorensen. Eric, what's going on, man?
What's going on? I had a trip to the doctor today. That's what's going on. Interspersed with meetings. Not for anything serious. I had to get my finger cut open because I had an infection on it. And, that's what's going on in my life. Getting fingers cut open.
Mm.
It's an exciting, eventful time, Dan.
Yeah. I don't have any of that going on in my life, so that's good.
That's good.
Yeah.
You don't want that going on.
Nothing's
you don't like getting parts of your body cut open isn't particularly awesome.
No, I don't. I don't plan on doing that. I haven't had any of that going on, mm-hmm. and I'm glad for it. Besides that, you're well, though.
I am well. I'm actually getting ready to travel. I'll be in the great state of Montana on Thursday and Friday. Saturday, I head to the great state of North Dakota and travel through that place for a couple days. And then I end up in Minneapolis on Tuesday. So I'll be doing a lot of traveling over the next week. That's what I'm gearing up for. So packing bags, getting ready to present all about our church plant epiphany here in New York. That's the big game coming up.
Yeah. Going to North Dakota, where we'll be going in May. For the CHF.
That is correct, sir.
For the CHF City event, we're going to be talking about the Psalms. You should probably come out if you're in that area. I mean, there's not a lot of things going on in North Dakota. This is probably the best thing that's going to be going on there this year. If you're in North Dakota or Montana or Minnesota or whatever, you should probably just make the journey over. Come hang out with me and Eric and Chad Bird and Chris Roseborough and Scott Keith and Cindy Koch. And we're going to talk about the Psalms. And it's going to be a great, great one-day event. You can go over to ChristHoldFast.org, go to the events, all the information's there. You can register, and we'd love to see you if you are in that area, or if you're just a diehard and you want to jump on a plane and just fly out there, you can do that too.
Yeah, all are welcome.
All are welcome.
It'll be a fun time.
It is. All right. So, Gospel of Matthew. Where are we at?
Gospel of Matthew, chapter 22, verse 15. Just to set up the context again, basically Jesus has been in the process of explaining to the religious establishment, the Pharisees and the Sadducees, why their time is over, why their unbelief has resulted in their rejection, and has done it most recently with a couple of parables very clearly speaking to them and to their predicament. And so now in verse 15, we're going to start to see the Pharisees and Sadducees fight back. Not that they haven't been fighting the whole time in some degree or another, but we have a whole series of different attacks that they try to do. And so that's where we pick it up here. It says, "Then the Pharisees went and plotted how to entangle him in his words. And they sent their disciples to him, along with the Herodians, saying, 'Teacher, we know that you are true and teach the way of God truthfully.'" Just dripping with sincerity, isn't it? "And you do not care about anyone's opinion, for you are not swayed by appearances."
By the way, those two things are not the same.
That's right. "Tell us then what you think. Is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar or not?" But Jesus, aware of their malice, said, "Why put me to the test, you hypocrites? Show me the coin for the tax." And they brought him a denarius. And Jesus said to them, "Whose likeness and inscription is this?" They said, "Caesar's." Then he said to them, "Therefore render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's." When they heard it, they marveled, and they left him and went away. Mm-hmm. I love that end. Like, all right, bye.
Like, I'm going to go home and think about that.
So, this passage is quoted all the time, especially for people that are talking about the church's connection to government and how much we should be connected. And this is one of those passages that actually is a little bit mysterious. So what do we need to do to unpack this a little bit?
Well, I think that part of what you're getting at here is that taxes, not unlike our own day, back then as well, are, no one likes them. No, like, what do you know? Taxes never been popular. So, so what you got is they're like, all right, here's what we'll do. Like this is a good, the reason they think this is a good way to trap Jesus is because they're like, there's not like a right answer to this. Mm-hmm. Like, should we pay taxes or not? Because if he says yes, the people will be like, man, like, we don't want to give the oppressive government our money. Mm-hmm. Like, we thought you were like revolutionary, man.
Right.
Come on. Mm-hmm. But if he says no, you shouldn't, then they can go to the Roman leaders and be like, this guy's inciting a tax rebellion.
Yeah, and in fact, this is the only time that you see both the Pharisees and the Herodians, representing the Romans, coming together. Mm-hmm. I mean, so this is they got both sides of the equation here, and so he's bound to upset one or the other. Mm-hmm. At least that's what they think.
But Jesus, being the man who invented communication, he destroys it right here. And I mean, the fact that when he's like, "Why do you put me to the test, you hypocrites?"
Yeah. Just talking smack right to their face,
just burning it down. Yeah, mm-hmm. So he gets a coin and he's like, "Yeah, whose likeness and inscription is this?" And of course, it's Caesar. So he says, "You know, give to Caesar what Caesar's, and to God the good things that are God's," which is an awesome response, because he doesn't make a statement about, well, let me tell you what I think an appropriate tax rate is, or, you know, let me tell you like about oppressive governments or anything like that. He like completely like answers the question in a way that no one's upset. They're all just astounded. Like they, right. I mean, they're all marveling. Right. And mm-hmm. essentially what he's saying is like, I think when I read this, what I hear is this: it's money, man. Like what, mm-hmm. why are you so attached to it?
Yeah.
Like that, I mean, that's pretty much it. Like, it's like, pay the taxes, man. Like, yeah, maybe it sucks, but like, it's money. And yeah, we got to have it to survive and that sort of thing. But if you think this is like the thing you're going to get me on, no. It's got Caesar's face on it. Let him have it.
Well, this is it's interesting the language that he uses here. He says, whose likeness and inscription is on the coin? And he says, since Caesar's likeness and inscription is on that, give it to him. But then he says, and give to God the things that are God's. Well, where is God's likeness and inscription? It is on your very person, you mm-hmm. as a human being. Mm-hmm. And so what he's saying here is, go ahead and give the tax to Caesar, or to any government for that matter. Give to God yourself. Mm-hmm. Give to God your person, that which has his inscription and likeness on it. That's the idea that's being communicated there. And they want to lump everything in together and say, if you're not all the way for Caesar, then you're an enemy of the state. And Jesus is able to make a distinction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So in this country, we've decided to try to get out of this by putting our leaders' likenesses, but God's inscription on the money.
That's right. In God We Trust is on all of our money. And yes, I don't know that it works real well. I think everybody still hates taxes just as much as they always have.
Hey, and I know this, like, putting In God We Trust on the money hasn't made anyone trust in money less.
That's correct. That is correct, Dan. So, yeah, so that's what, I mean, so that's the first shot. That's the first time they try and trap him in this passage and fail. So let's move on to the next shot. This time it's the Sadducees. The same day the Sadducees came to him, who say that there is no resurrection, and they asked him a question, saying, "Teacher, Moses said, if a man dies having no children, his brother must marry the widow and raise up children for his brother. Now there were seven brothers among us. The first married and died, and having no children, left his wife to his brother. So too the second and third, down to the seventh. After them all, the woman died. In the resurrection, therefore, of the seven, whose wife will she be? For they all had her." Ooh, here's the trap. "But Jesus answered them, you are wrong, because you know neither the scriptures nor the power of God. Again, no fear. For in the resurrection, they neither marry nor are given in marriage, but are like angels in heaven. And as for the resurrection of the dead, have you not read what was said to you by God? I am the God of Abraham and the God of Isaac and the God of Jacob. He is not God of the dead, but of the living. And when the crowd heard it, they were astonished at his teaching. Strike two.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a pretty good one. You know, this story is actually interesting. So you have this woman who, like, all these brothers are, like, dying, apparently. Like, they're just dropping like flies, man. Which is just a weird, creepy ordeal. That whole thing is not something I want to be a part of. But this story actually appears in, if you have the Apocrypha, you actually have this is an actual story in it. And what ends up happening is, like, you have these brothers believing that, like, this woman is cursed and stuff. And mm-hmm. and so they come in with this, like, sort of tale from the old school lit, and they're like, yeah, mm-hmm. so like, we know this is, like, a story in our you know, in our sacred texts or whatever, but we don't believe in that resurrection. And look at this right here in the sacred lit. We've got a story where, like, lots of guys are married to this one woman. What about in the resurrection? Mm-hmm. Then what? How do you explain that, Jesus? And he's like, I mean, who's that? Like, do you not know the scriptures? Like, that's yeah. just amazing. Or the power of God. And then, you know, essentially says, look, man, like, we ain't going to have husbands and wives when all things are created new.
Yeah, this is, I think for some is a troublesome passage, right? I mean, the idea that the person you spend your life with, that you love more intimately than anyone else, that knows you more than anyone else, and the marriage is over for this life, or once this life is done. Why is that?
Well, I think that it's because we are corporately the bride of Christ. And so it's not that we are mm-hmm. not in an intimate relationship. Obviously it's very, it's different, but corporately the church, I mean, is the bride and Christ is the groom. And so we are not married to each other, but we are given to Christ as his church, mm-hmm. as his bride. So, you know, I think, like, that kind of stuff is tough for us. You know, like, we think about, surely, you know, well, like, how can I not, like, will I have, like, special feelings for, like, I won't have that anymore. Like, I won't have that same connection and attachment that I have with my spouse. Mm-hmm. And I don't think what he says here necessarily, like, negates all of that either. I don't think it's as if you won't even know that you were, you know, married to this person or that you had children with this person. I don't think your memory wiped or anything like that. Like, I think you'll totally know that stuff. But I think that at that point, your identity will be so rooted in your relationship to the Son of God, that all things that we can look back on with fondness pale in comparison.
Yeah. Yeah. And as far as how he defends the doctrine of the resurrection of the dead, it might be a little tricky to see at first. So you have to pay close attention to the language that he uses. His proof text is, he says, have you not read what was said to you by God? I am the God of Abraham and the God of Isaac and the God of Jacob. The key there, I think, is understanding that he says, I am, present tense, of the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, even after Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob have died. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. He is still their God, and he is presently their God. Which is, the implication is, that means that they are still alive.
Right.
That they are alive now. And so that's what his point is that God doesn't say, I was their God when they were alive, but I am now.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. That, he doesn't say, like, hey, I was the God. I was the God of Abraham, and I was the God of Isaac, and I should be your God too. No, he says, I currently am, still am. That I am the God. It is interesting that the Sadducees don't, are sort of, they're a smaller group than the Pharisees. And yeah, like the sort of the dividing issue is the resurrection of the dead.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, for our purposes, I mean, there's obviously nuance here, but in case you're not aware of the distinctions between the Pharisees and the Sadducees, both of them were on what was the ruling council in Judaism of the day, known as the Sanhedrin. But the Pharisees were, for the most part, the more conservative side of the aisle when it came to the scriptures, when it came to practice, and the Sadducees, for our terms today, could have been seen as more liberal or more progressive. But both of them were deeply involved in the leadership of the Jewish people in Judea.
Yeah, and the resurrection was, I mean, obviously there was a lot of differences, but that was sort of the big dividing. I mean, that's a pretty big. Yes. That's a pretty big theological difference.
Yes, yes, indeed. One's staking their whole existence on eternity; the other is not.
Right.
So, yeah, that's a big deal. So that's the second attack, and it doesn't work out real well for the Sadducees. And so we come to the next attack. But when the Pharisees heard that he had silenced the Sadducees, they gathered together. And one of them, a lawyer, asked him a question to test him. "Teacher, which is the great commandment in the law?" And he said to him, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. This is the great and first commandment. And the second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments depend all the law and the prophets." So Jesus, I mean, why doesn't he mention all 10 commands? Why doesn't he, I mean, we don't see this spelled out in the 10 commandments exactly this way.
Yeah, no, I mean, this is more of a condensed, you see this language a little bit in Deuteronomy where we'll talk about loving your neighbor as yourself and this sort of thing. But I think what's crazy about this, like, this seems like such like a grasp here. Like, you know, they heard that he silenced the Sadducees, they gathered together, and one of them asked him this question to test him, right? And like, I don't really understand entirely the motivation here, where he's like crushed it on this answer, and then they're like, let's ask him what the greatest commandment is. This dude knows what the commandments are. I think that, like, what you have to assume is going on here is that they believe Jesus to be someone who doesn't take the law seriously.
Right.
Like, I was just going to say that
I think that they think he's an antinomian.
Right. They're like, does this guy even know what the first and great commandment is? And yes. What he does, he's like, oh, I know what it is. I wrote it with my finger in tablets of stone. But yeah, I know what it is. It's this. You know, you love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and mind. But the second is like it. Love your neighbor as yourself. And I think that they don't ask him they don't ask him to list the Ten Commandments. They don't ask him what the second commandment is. They just say, what's the first and great? What's the great commandment in the law? And he gives them the summary of the entire law, as Jesus says, the entirety of the commandments rest on these two. And the reason Jesus brings in the second is because these guys are so wrapped up in this loving God with all their heart, soul, and mind, which is literally what they try to portray publicly, that they've devoted their lives to the love of God, so much so that they've, like, put the law in, like, a little box and strapped it to their forehead so they can be like, yeah, I'm loving God with all my mind right now, that Jesus, like, busts them up with a word and says, like, actually, there's more commandments than just that one. And the rest of them involve your neighbor. And by the way, you're terrible at that. Not to mention, of course, that, like, you don't love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. You don't do that. But also, there's more in the law, and you're really missing it on that front, too.
Well, I mean, the fact is, the first commandment cannot be fulfilled apart from the second commandment.
Right
here, you know, in this particular the way he breaks it down.
Well, Jesus agrees that if you break one commandment, you break all of them.
Mm-hmm.
Jesus agrees with with that statement.
So, I mean, these two things have to go together, and you'll see Jesus lumping them together throughout his ministry. And listen, I mean, they do think he's an antinomian. They think Jesus is against the law. He lets his disciples pick grain on the Sabbath. He heals on the Sabbath. He does all sorts of things to at least be accused of being a glutton and a drunkard by these same people. Jesus seems to be a threat to their upholding of the law, their love of the law. And what Jesus is essentially saying is, no, I love the law, but I love the law when it's actually like the actual law, not all your added rules, not all your stipulations, not all your prohibitions that you had to make up. I love the actual law, and that actual law is actually shown by love to the neighbor.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And you haven't done that.
Yeah, and I like each time that there's like no response from them, really. They're just kind of like, oh, okay.
Yeah, every time I picture them, like, I picture this almost like a kid's game. Like, they're huddled up in a corner, like a bunch of them are huddled in, and then one of them comes out, almost like maybe like a battle rap or something like that. Like, one of them gets the courage, like, all right, bro, watch this. And he walks forward, and he tests Jesus, and Jesus gives him an answer, and he just backs up slowly, like quietly, like, okay, sorry. And then they go back and they plot again. And they, hey, man, what about this? What about this? Yeah, try that one. And it's just fail after fail after fail. I mean, now Jesus is going to punch back. Now, while the Pharisees were gathered together, Jesus asked them a question, saying, what do you think about the Christ? Whose son is he? They said to him, the son of David. They're right. He said to them, how is it then that David, in the Spirit, calls him Lord? Saying, the Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand until I put your enemies under your feet. If then David calls him Lord, how is he his son? And no one was able to answer him a word, nor from that day did anyone dare to ask him any more questions. Well, they're done.
That's it.
They've admitted defeat.
Yeah. This is actually a pretty great response by Jesus. So they get three strikes. They're all out. So Jesus gets up to bat. He only needs one swing, crushes it. They got no answer. And yeah, so the question is like, so essentially whose son is the Messiah going to be, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's the son of David. It's like, oh, that's interesting. How come David mm-hmm. calls him Lord? Of course, I mean, the answer to this question is that Jesus is the eternal son of God.
Right.
He's both son of David by lineage mm-hmm. in the flesh, but he is incarnate of the Holy Spirit and is the eternal son of God. So he is both David's son and David's Lord. But they don't exactly have their head around that theology in any way, shape, or form. So this just became an entire mind scramble for them.
Yeah, what Jesus is exposing here by asking this question is that as much as they think they're the supreme and superior theologians of the nation of Israel, they really haven't figured out the most essential question, the most essential part, and that is the identity of the Messiah. It's as if they haven't thought about how it is that David can refer to the anointed one as his Lord if he's also his son. This is, of course, scandalous to them. And this is what gets him ultimately arrested. This is the proof that they need. This is the beginning of that proof that they need to get him put on trial for blasphemy.
Right. It's an interesting thing to think about that in the mind of the religious leaders of that day, this was not a concept that they had grasped, that the Messiah would be God in flesh. That's not an opinion they held. They hadn't, like, I mean, it is all over the prophets and the Old Testament. It's certainly
yes.
there, but they had not pieced that together. And so they are looking for a man. They are looking for a descendant of David. They're looking for David 2.0. They're looking for a messianic anointing on him, that he'd be God's chosen messenger and deliverer and that kind of stuff. But all their deliverers before that, you know, Moses and David and whoever, had been, they're men that God is called to do that. And that's what they're looking for. They're not like, is God himself going to wrap himself in flesh? That's not a concept yeah. they were working with.
No, it's a this is where the apostles. That's why they spend so much time developing this and preaching this. I mean, especially John. John is so very, very crystal clear. To use the theological terminology, he has a high Christology
right
in all of his writings. That is to say, like, he's constantly laboring to show people, like, no, he's not merely just anointed as a man. He is God in the flesh. He is the Word, the eternal Logos that became flesh. Mm-hmm. And this is the absolute mind-blowing thing that the early church is preaching that people just have no concept of.
Right, right. I mean, like, and honestly, like, there's still, like, a lot of, you know, within aberrant Christian groups, there's still those who get hung up on the deity of Christ, that mm-hmm. he is fully God, that mm-hmm. God became sin, that God was crucified and died. This is too much.
Yeah.
It's too much. It is still the stumbling block for the Jews. This is mm-hmm. the big hang up is that, like, God has made himself low, made himself one of us, and died.
And by doing so has ransomed all.
Right.
Has forgiven the sins of many.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so we see after this whole thing that they have no idea what he's talking about. I mean, and it's weird that he doesn't give them the answer. Like, it's not like he blows their mind and is like, let me explain it to you, boys. That's not how he does. He, like, asks a question, and they can't answer it, and he just leaves them there. Like, yeah, you chew on that for a while. And then, what it does is, like, and after that, they're just like, don't ask this guy any more questions. Like, this dude has, like, won every Bible trivia youth group competition in the history of the world. Like, don't mess with this guy anymore. Like, he's got all the answers. And not only does he have all the answers, apparently he's got much harder questions to answer than we're dishing out to him.
Right. And so as a result, I mean, the judgment language will continue in next week's passage on our next podcast when Jesus just unleashes on the Pharisees the seven woes. In other words, the proclamations of why their condemnation is just. And he is going just crush them. And again, it's all part of the plan. This is what's going to eventually get him arrested in just a few short chapters.
Yeah, yeah. Matthew 23 is a flamethrower of a chapter. So we'll see if we make it through that bad boy next week. But it'll have to be next week because we are out of time. We will be back, though, with the seven woes in Matthew 23. Eric, until then, we'll see you later.
All right, very good.